Hello, and welcome to Dialogues Dispatch, a podcast series from Google on technology and society. I'm James Manyika, and for today's dispatch, I'm delighted to be joined by a prominent economist and chair of Grantham Institute on Climate Change and the Environment, Lord Nicholas Stern. We'll be discussing how we realize the full potential for AI for sustainability in ways that are globally inclusive and equitable. Lord Stern, thank you for joining me.
It's a real pleasure to be with you, James. Thank you.
It's been a year since the publication of your report, The Global Growth Story of the 21st Century, which I was delighted to be a contributor. I know we talked about it quite a bit as you were developing that. I'd like to reflect on what's happened since. Have we made progress in your view? What are the big gaps that you think still exist?
I think we have made quite a lot of progress since we had a conversation around those issues. And the report was about how AI and the transition to the green sustainable economy come together and support each other. And I've been working for a long time on climate crisis and the need to radically change our economies. And I think it's extremely fortunate that AI has started to come through so strongly just at the moment where we need pace and we need system change. And AI is good at pace and system change. So the pace of AI just at this moment has picked up, as we all know, over the last year or so. Events, there's been COP28 in Dubai, which was really rather positive in terms of commitment to move away from fossil fuels. There was a meeting of the IMF and World Bank in Marrakesh in October 2023, where there was broad agreement that the multilateral development banks and international financial institutions must scale up and reorient towards the private sector and so on. So if you look at the pace of change of AI itself over this last year or so, if you look at the international commitments that we've seen, I've just given two big examples. You know, one is the conference on climate change and the other the financial institutions. You've seen a reorienting. It's not all been positive. There's been a bit of a renaissance in the anti-movement from vested interests like fossil fuels. There's been litigation in the United States. There's been a prolongation of the Russia-Ukraine war, which disturbs markets. So I'm hoping that the positives outweigh the negatives. And I think the positives, I hope, are of longer lasting effect than the negatives.
I want to put this topic of pace in a bit of context. I mean, clearly, we may not be moving fast enough with regards to the problem we're trying to solve. But in terms of the world coming round to doing something about this, you're giving the sense that we are moving faster, but some historical context. Remind me again when you wrote this term report.
Well, it was published in 2006. We started work in 2005. So that's nearly 20 years.
Nearly 20 years ago. The reason I bring that up is because when you first put that very influential Stern report in 2006, the world was in a very different place. Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting that since that time until now, you're seeing the world get organized? Are we moving at pace? And are we keeping up with the pace of the problem we need to solve?
No. I mean, we lost a lot of time in that 20 years. I think Paris in 2015 gave a real kick forward because it told the world where we were going. It made the commitment to hold well below 2 degrees and to best efforts for 1.5. And it recognized that the current pace of change, and indeed the current commitment to change, was totally inconsistent with that. So it gave a new signal of direction. And if you look at the way in which technology has changed since Paris, I don't think any of us at Paris thought that the clean would be cheaper than the dirty. Over so much of emissions now, probably at least a third of emissions, and maybe in 5-6 years, it'll be 2/3 of emissions. So we were slow for a long time. We picked up in Paris, which is almost 10 years after the Stern review. And then I think in recent years, we've seen the technology story move very quickly. So having the clean cheaper than the dirty is critical. Like we talk about tipping points on the climate side, it's a tipping point on the economic side. But we have to invest to get there. It's one thing to say, actually, the possibilities are opening up. They are. But you've got to invest a lot to get there. 2-3 percentage points across the world of GDP probably is a lower limit of what we have to invest. And one of the great things about AI it could reduce the amount of investment we have to make by making it smarter.
How could AI actually help us address the climate and sustainability challenge? How do you see that?
If you take the big systems, energy, transport, cities, land, water, how we transform cities is a complex problem, and we haven't got time for a lot of experiments. So, you know, the old idea of the digital twin, of course, AI is way beyond that. But it's the example to help people understand how we can make experiments without actually turning lots of cities upside down and seeing which one works the best. Because A, people wouldn't go along with it. And B, we haven't got the time to do that. So trying to understand how those big systems work. Now, we in the UK, and you could tell by my accent where I come from, indeed London, we should be linking up with Morocco. We should be linking up with Iceland and geothermal. You know, we should be linking up with Northern Europe and all the wind. These are the kinds of systemic change would allow us to do so much more. How fast can you do that? How does it work? How do you run those systems? How do you make them robust? How do you integrate your energy system with your transport systems and your cities? We have to make those changes in 5, 10, 15 years. We cannot have the time to experiment. AI can deliver technological system change at digital speed, just as it can do science at digital speed.
Yeah, and no, I have to say, I mean, in the last year since you wrote that very important paper, I've just been astounded by the progress we've been making and using AI, both on the mitigation side, but also on the adaptation side. Just to give two quick examples, the ability to predict and actually solve for contrails, that the contrail effect contributes to warming. In fact, some suggest that as much as a third of the warming due to aviation and aviation transport is due to the contrail effect. Now, so it turns out that you can actually use AI to predict the right flight patterns to dramatically minimize. So we actually did a series of trials with American Airlines. The pilots flew routes suggested by the AI algorithm to minimize the contrail effect.
Fantastic.
And on those flights, they were able to reduce the contrail effect by as much as 54%, which is astounding. So you're starting to have agencies around the world starting to explore the possibility of actually doing that as a way to mitigate. Another quick example is something called Project Greenlight, which turns out in cities, you mentioned cities, the amount of contribution to emissions due to stop-start at traffic lights is actually quite a lot. And so you can actually predict that and plan for that and reduce the effect by suggesting routes that actually minimize that by as much as 10-12%.
That's wonderful. And those examples of the contrails in traffic lights, making them work better in cities, are examples of how a small piece can give you quite substantial changes. But imagine then if we situate those things in the big system of the whole flight paths around the world and how they all fit together, because we know that those can be complex, and that if you've got an idea of that kind you've described, you could actually start rerouting all sorts of things and get something which is even bigger, much bigger, systemic, if you like.
Yes.
And then if you think of cities, you've got pedestrians, cyclists, autonomous vehicles coming along and non-autonomous vehicles, and you've got the taxis and you've got the buses and the trains and the metros and so on. How do you design so that that fits together in a way which is much more efficient and, very importantly in all this, much easier, more comfortable for ordinary people to use? You've given very powerful examples of a bit of it.
Yes.
And imagine if you took that to the systemic level. The other point you raised around adaptation is enormously important. And individuals and firms and cities and governments really need to know what's coming. And if you know about a flood a few hours before, even better if you know about a few days before, you can do so much. And you need that, not sort of southern England, you know, in my village, you know, in Elsted, in West Sussex. We need to know what's happening there, right? Indeed, I'd actually rather like to know what's going to happen in my house. So the specification in adaptation of locality and precision is so important. And there, big data is absolutely fundamental.
Just to build on that, the flood forecast example, since you wrote the paper, we actually ran a small experiment in Bangladesh for flood forecasting, because it turns out that if you can actually forecast floods with something like 7 days advance notice, the benefit of that is huge versus a day.
Yeah.
It worked in Bangladesh. We expanded it to India. Now, almost nearly a year later, we've actually deployed it in 82 countries.
Wonderful.
Covering 472 million people who now get flood alerts. And so the impact of that is enormous. But there's so many other examples like that, even including predicting wildfire boundaries, which we're now doing, I think, in over a dozen countries. So, yeah, so there is a lot to be done on the adaptation side. But I want to come back to something you said, which got me quite interested. Sounds like you think that we need to work on so many dimensions. These are systems we're trying to change. Say more about how we should imagine and think about system change.
We've already discussed a little bit about cities, where you're trying to fit together different modes of transport, where how you adjust in one area cannot be discussed. You can't talk about pedestrians and buses without talking about where the metro stations are and so on. And many cities around the world are putting in metros. We've had an underground railway in London for a long time, and of course some of it is creaking at the seams. But many, many cities of the world, particularly in emerging markets and developing economies, are putting in their metros. Are they doing that without thinking about all the other things, about how the road system works, the bus system works, how people get around on bicycles? My guess is that many of them are. So getting into that early and saying, let's try to design all those things together because they are a system.
Right.
You know, the energy systems, it's going to be very important to link up over space, particularly when we're using more renewables, which can fluctuate a bit. But a well-organized electricity system, say, okay, there's a bit more coming in over there. Well, if we're linked up, we can say, well, we can match it with a bit more that's coming in from over there. And over there might be a few thousand kilometers away because we can transport electricity quite quickly. But matching all that complicated geography, and of course, shifting over pace, shifting over time. You know, we're all used to charging up our electric vehicles, which is cheap electricity overnight. But that's just one bit, right? So you're going to have to organize those energy systems so they link up and manage over space and time. And so much more is possible if you've got that kind of information. The whole land use system is enormously complex. And let me just give you one example, which is sort of Sian land, and it's mangroves. Many of us are great mangrove enthusiasts. They stop storm surges. They store carbon in a wonderful way, much better than most trees, actually. You know, and they can take out toxins and they can encourage the fish. Now, you've got the whole coast of Bangladesh and India on that east side, putting in a lot of mangroves, which is what's being discussed now. And it's good, great that it's being discussed. That must be a complicated systemic problem. You know, you've probably got a few hundred or thousand kilometers that you're talking about. It that could have a profound effect on the coastline and within the coastline. We hope positive, but you better understand it before you embark on something like that. And again, there's just a few examples of big systems, and the forests themselves is deeply worrying. I mean, we don't know when the Amazonia forest system will collapse. It's a complicated system. We've taken out maybe 20% of it. Will it collapse at 25%, 35%? We don't know. We need to, right? And so modeling that kind of complicated system must be hard, but it's enormously important and soon.
This brings us back to the question of pacing. If I think about pace and systemic change, I can see, of course, the modeling and the technical innovations we can do with that. But a lot of complex system change must take into account, or at least interoperate somehow, with our economic systems.
Absolutely.
With our policymaking. How do we make systems in that sense, where we harness what's possible technologically, how humans and societies behave, with also our economic systems, in order to make this all of this work together and somewhat harmonized with policymaking too?
Yeah, James, that's so important. And many people now, particularly scientists and technologists who actually feel that they've got to grips with much of what we need to do, tell us, and I don't think they're wrong, that you know maybe two-thirds of the difficulties that we have to overcome are economic, social, political. And that as we see more and more clearly what we can do, of course, we have to discover much more, but we can see now how to move. We run into social, political, economic difficulties. And if you look back to the, you know, the steam engine and electricity and the internal combustion engine and internet and so on. Each time those things come along, and they've all been forces for good, there is a period of dislocation. And if we can understand that dislocation better, and if we can understand how to manage the dislocation better, then we can move faster and we can be more decent about human beings and society. Because you can't just say, well, that's tough. You know, you used to work in a coal mine. We've decided we can't do coal anymore, which we have decided correctly. And that's tough. You know, you way back then, you made a bad choice, didn't you? Well, I'm going to live with it. That's not something that we should be prepared to say. And so how do we understand how best to invest in people and places? And here's a real problem for AI and social sciences. Because, you know, what we just gave five or six examples of big periods of technological change over 150 years or so. And the economic historians have helped us learn. But there are not many examples, right? And simply if you're looking at recessions and unemployment, I mean, it comes all too often, but it doesn't mean there are that many of them. So here's a real challenge, a methodological challenge for us all, is that we now see, in the wonderful words of our friend, you know, Demis Hassabis, that AI can deliver science at digital speed. Can AI deliver social science at digital speed? I don't want to give up on that, but it ain't easy because there's not enough of the really big things. There are plenty of consumers who are buying X, Y, and Z and lots of data on that. AI is really good for that, but not so much for how to handle the really big events. And my goodness, we're handling in the intersection of AI and the green transition a really big event.
Nick, you're right to point out the fact that we haven't had these many fundamental technological changes over time, and AI is one of those. It's a general purpose technology.
Absolutely.
In the sense that you can see it applicable in many areas of the economy, individual activity, business, economic activity, and those don't come very often. Electricity, steam engine, in the internet, perhaps, were historical examples. I hope we've learned some lessons from those previous ones. It seems to me that there are a couple we should learn, at least a few. One is the fact that we have to think quite ahead about particularly the intersection of the labor markets and what people do. After the Industrial Revolution, we had the long period of Engels' pause, where it was very messy as society adjusted. Part of preparing the labor markets, at least in the case of AI, is, first of all, how do we design it and deploy it in a ways that are complementary and assistive as opposed to substitutive? To what people do. How do we think about proactively about skills adaptation and how to handle that and enable workers to be equipped with the right skills? How do we also manage the transitions? Because we know some occupations are probably going to decline while some other ones are going to grow and many more are going to change. How do we deal with those dislocations? I hope we've learned something.
Yeah.
And it's a policy, societal, and economic set of questions to deal with all of that.
I think the first thing is to look ahead and try to anticipate where those things likely to cut the hardest. And that we should be able to do, because if you're going to firms and so on and saying, here's what you can do for you, you can get by with less labor in this area, actually that same process will allow us to predict what might happen. So it's not just the firm that's at issue here, it's all the people around it and in the supply chains and so on. So as we implement the idea, we have the material to look ahead to see who and where might be deeply affected by all this. That should be, it seems to me, a moral responsibility as part of the application of AI to look ahead and anticipate those things, because the earlier we see them, just like floods, the earlier we see them, better we can act. The second thing is investing in people and places.
Yeah.
Because it's people who are dislocated. It's places that are hit because a lot of activity will be concentrated. So how can we invest? We've got to forecast those. Sometimes easy, sometimes less easy. Mm-hmm. And in a world that's changing quickly, it's what you've got as a human being that matters the most, and it's what's on offer round where you are. You can't tell everybody to get on your bike and go somewhere else, you know. Some people will, and of course they do. But you have to understand the people in places, how to equip the people in places to be really nimble. We talk in language economics, like human capital. What have they got in themselves that can actually help them discover things from themselves, but what is around them, which determines what's available to them. So I think thinking ahead and investing in people and places is part of the duty of all involved in AI.
Whether we're talking about climate change, sustainability, whether we're talking about the kind of fundamental changes to the economy and society that AI is going to bring, we have to take almost a systemic approach. And that, to me, seems as if it's also important to do it together, because you've got lots of actors. You've got people developing AI, people deploying AI, people using AI, people writing policy and incentives around that. Those are companies, those are governments, those are innovators. So there's something about a collective endeavor here to achieve responsibly the kind of systemic change that we want to benefit everybody.
And a big part of benefiting everybody is the education that allows them to look forward and the health that gives them the ability to go and make things happen. And we know that those two areas, AI is very powerful.
What are you most excited about for this year?
I think the excitement is how fast the clean is moving relative to the dirty, and enormously important, how fast the developing world is now seeing that it can do things differently, that it can leapfrog, and that there's a much better model of development than the dirty, destructive model of the past. And that's the most hopeful sign. India, China, much of Africa, not everywhere, and not everybody equally enthusiastic. But I think the tide is changing in terms of the vision of the very different way of growing and developing.
Well, that's perhaps an optimistic place to end. Good to see you, Nick.
As always, great talking to you, James.